Okay, well, let's get started, and if others join subsequently, we'll add them in and do sound checks and all that. But Mimi and I and Frank spoke yesterday about learning from the first two of these, and we thought that to sort of increase a kind of climate of interactivity, we would all start by saying a few words about what our research interests are, how we come to be interested in this particular webinar, whether we're just kind of hanging out to find out what's going on, or whether we have some research that's ongoing that we really want to sort of build on some of the work that Mimi's been doing for some time. So if we could have each person or at each site have people talk about maybe 2-3 minutes about who they are and how this work is related to what they're doing, that would be great. I think if everybody clicks to join the queue, then it'll run more smoothly. And then when I stop broadcasting, the first person in the queue should come up and see a stop broadcasting below their the big video picture. And then after you're done, hit that button. And then when we're done with those introductions, I'll come back and say a few words about our speaker today, Mimi Recker. And then she will begin talking. She's going to talk for about 20 minutes. And we talked about ways to increase interactivity. And the plan is that she will make her comments and periodically build in some questions for us to think about, along with some pauses if you're with a group to sort of think about a response to them. I mentioned earlier that the chat tab in the lower part of the Flash meeting screen can be used to type comments. What we thought was that as facilitator, one of my roles would be to monitor that chat window. And if you have questions for discussion that occur to you as Mimi is talking, or that you want to put in now based on the reading that you did, go ahead and do that, and I will try to synthesize those for when Mimi finishes her presentation. We'll be able to use those to seed the discussion. So I'm going to stop now, and the next person in the queue will be up. Thanks.
Hi, we're here at the University of Washington. I'm Elaine Klein, a second-year doc student. I feel like this work relates to what I'm doing. Last year, we worked on a project where teachers were all across the country, and our main point of collaboration was using an online platform. So it was an interesting experience, and I'm interested to hear more about sort of how to think about that work and how to think about the data, too, that we got out of that.
Hi, my name is Sinead Miles. I'm a first-year master's student in learning sciences, and my area of interest is working with Native communities. Just created a pilot leadership program for early childhood development. And so looking at how to work with adult learners and rural communities and how technology can facilitate that process.
I'm Diana Scipio, a fifth year learning sciences doc student here. And my interest is in mentors and how and what they learn in informal learning environments. And so I'm really curious to see how we can use technology, specifically video clubs, to facilitate mentors watching themselves teach and how we can help them develop as reflective practitioners. So I'm really curious as to how technology can facilitate that process.
And I'm Phil Bell, faculty here in learning sciences, and the broad work has to do with how and where people learn science in ways that are consequential to them. I worked with Elaine on the project last year funded by Gates Foundation to engage a network of teachers and taking up this project-based curriculum that we had developed in English, language arts, and biology. It also included looping in experts remotely to work with kids and teachers around contemporary ways that knowledge shows up out in work-related spaces. The other new project that we just are launching now actually is related to the adoption of next-gen science standards here in Washington State, where we have a network of 70 teachers across two districts adapting curriculum to align better with that vision, and we're using the Teaching Channel Teams portal to do a video-based PD initiative with them. And that's it for us here at UW. Over.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Ito. I'm at Indiana University, and I'm a third-year learning sciences doctoral student. My interests lie in developing and designing professional development for in-service teachers, specifically participatory professional development, and integrating social theories of learning into their practice.
Hi, this is Freides from the University of Munich. I'm interested in the talk today, I think, from two sides. One side is more from the research side and one side more from the practical side. So from the research side, I'm much interested in how maybe those teachers, when creating those courses, could be instructional supported, or what are the problems that should be solved, maybe with instructional support. And the other is more from the formatical side of this theme that I think I'm also involved in higher education teaching and how people can use technology to teach, and I would like to hear more about that.
Susan, sorry, on your side, we still can't hear you. If you try with the chat or try to fix the system again, sorry.
Hello, I'm Vera Gehlenbaum, I'm from the University of Saarland, and my research interest is in how to support lectures, or especially large lectures with technology. And we found out that students use their mobile devices in lectures, but they use it most of the time for unrelated stuff. So they are surfing on Facebook, or they're surf different websites, but most of the time they're not using it for lecture related stuff. And so what we try to do is to support students to use technology for lecture support, and also to support the teacher or the lecturer at the same time. And I think what Mimi did is perhaps going to help what we are doing, as also we see that lecturers have sometimes a problem to use different kinds of technology.
So my name is Frank Fischer. Today I'm also a participant, and I'm really interested in today's topic, also because of my own experience in research projects with respect to teacher collaboration and the difficulties that teacher collaboration brings with it, at least in Germany and some European countries, but I guess that might be worldwide. And I would be very much interested in hearing also a bit about how these difficulties can be overcome by with technology support, and also motivational support, I guess.
Hi everyone, this is Wen Zhen. I'm a graduate student in the UIC Learning Science PhD program, and I just defended my dissertation, yay! All right. The reason I'm interested in this is because I have been working with Dr. Superfine on designing video cases to support pre-service teachers' learning of mathematical knowledge. So we really trying to understand how the video case we design can support our pre-service teachers' development.
And my interest in the whole issue of teacher professional development comes out of work we're trying to do with enhancing literacy skills, as well as mathematics, especially formative assessment among teachers. We have been exploring ways to create resources for teachers as well as for others who are engaged in enacting professional development with teachers, and are trying to figure out ways to put these together in modules, in a sense, that are usable, accessible, and annotated, so that when others access them, they sort of know what to do with them, know what they were intended to do, etc. So the kind of platform that Mimi is talking about is potentially one that we might want to sort of look at as a way to create libraries of resources, both for teachers as well as for professional developers. I think that's everybody, so I think I'm just going to give you a little bit of a blurb about Mimi Recker's background. She is a professor and the department head of the Department of Instructional Technology and Learning Sciences at Utah State University. She also spent some time in Victoria University in New Zealand some years ago, but time there nonetheless, and was a research scientist in the College of Computing at Georgia Institute of Technology, as well as having been a software engineer at SRI. She got her PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. I'm going to turn it over to her at this point so that she can get started with her comments.
Great. Well, thank you for that introduction. And I want to start by thanking Frank and all the folks in this Naples network for putting on this really incredible set of webinars. I was just astounded to see the lineup of people that we have over this next academic year. And sadly, the information didn't really get to our university till this week. So I hope that starting from this point on, we'll have more folks from our program participating. If you could send that first URL, Frank, just to set the context. Frank, are you out there?
I am. The problem is that I have to send also this. So you will be transported to a website now, and I will be, maybe we do it in another way. I just copy. Let's try. This is how Flash Meeting would like to do that.
Okay, just very quickly about Utah State University. We're a land-grant institution, and in the United States that means a institution that has a particular mission to reach out to the citizens of the state who may be out in remote areas, and the state of Utah has many, many remote areas. We're in a small college town in the northern part of the state with lots of outdoor recreation opportunities. I wanted to mention that if there's any master's students out there or any faculty who have students interested in this, we have a four-year fellowship starting next year in the area, a doctoral fellowship in the area of the maker movement and its role in education. So if that is something that is of interest to you, or you know students that may be interested in that, please have them contact me. I think it's a really great opportunity. And this whole maker movement and how it fits into education is just a fascinating way to think about engaging students in learning through technology. Excuse me. I would like then to maybe send out the link for the PDF for today's slides. Can you do that, Frank? So this should open a PDF either inside your website. So I'll give it a few moments. It should either open up inside your web browser or an external viewer. If you are not seeing the PDF, perhaps type something in the chat and we can try again. So these are the slides for today. I'll refer to the slide numbers as we work through this. So let's go to slide 2. It's a bit of a parallel processing for all of us here. As we've talked about and as is reflected among the participants today, teacher learning has long been an interest in the learning sciences. I think there's a very nice summary chapter of this in the Cambridge Handbook of Learning Sciences by Fishman and Davis. That handbook came out in the mid-2000s, and I recommend that for a nice overview of the work on teacher learning. there's a number of very interesting research strands thinking about teacher learning from a learning sciences perspective, looking at how teachers learn in the moment through classroom teaching, and that's some great work by Miriam Shearham, for example, how teachers learn from curriculum materials, sometimes called educative curriculum materials. That's some work by Davis and Kratchik. How teacher learning can be fostered through professional development. And here there's a very long line of excellent work. And how teachers can learn through modifying and enacting curricula in their classroom. And this is sometimes known generically as teacher as design. Now, at the same time, with the new emergence of technology, there's been an increased focus on the role technology can play in fostering and helping teacher learning. So, for example, there's been some research on online teacher professional development, including some of the people here today have done work in this, using video as a way to help teacher learning. Again, some folks here are working in that particular area. Looking at teacher beliefs and looking at how technology adoption, that process, can also help teacher learning. So just tremendous lines of research, all very interesting. And what I want to talk about today, if you go on to the next slide, so this will be slide 3, yes, is a notion that we've been putting forth that we've put under the umbrella of crowd teaching. And this looks at this idea of collective intelligence communities, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a minute, teaching teachers as designers, and how this can foster both teacher learning as well as potentially improved teaching and improved instructional materials. So that's the very broad umbrella that we're working under. If you go on to the next slide, slide 4, this work is motivated by several trends. The first trend, as I mentioned earlier, is this idea of teachers as designers. And there's a very nice summary article in the additional readings that I provided by Remillard. And this came out in the Review of Education Research. And she summarizes different ways of thinking about teacher as designer and kind of settles on this idea that curriculum is seldom implemented unchanged in classrooms. And in fact, there's lots of enactments by teachers that tailor it to their particular context in ways that can lead to improved student learning. And this process, teaching and designing, is a really fruitful area of inquiry. So that's one line. The second line is this notion, this idea that we are just overwhelmed with open educational resources provided through the internet. Open educational resources roughly refer to anything on the internet that has a potential educational value, be these simulations, be these data sets, be these visualizations, be these chat rooms, very, very broad term. But now we are, you know, the teacher is not restricted to one set of curriculum materials. Instead, there's a sea of options, and some might even argue too many options. Another trend is free, easy-to-use authoring tools, for example, is provided by the Google platform, so that with technology tools, the bar for becoming a designer is much, much lower. The fourth trend is under this idea of participatory web culture. The internet has afforded this ability for all of us to move from being consumers to producers of media in an area that provides, that supports something called collective intelligence. Peer production is another term. Crowdsourcing is yet another term. This is exemplified, I think, maybe the best example is Wikipedia, where teams of people connected by the internet and loosely organized have put together an encyclopedia. Linux, of course, is another well-known example where teams of programmers around the world work together to produce free and open software. I want to stop here and pause for a moment to have you either reflect if you're on your own or talk among your little group to think about some other examples of collective intelligence or peer production that you may know of or you may have worked of that is especially appropriate to the teaching and learning context. So I'll pause here for about 3 minutes.
I'm not sure if I understood it right, because I wasn't sure if I just should reflect or just answer something, but what came in was, I just answer now, maybe this was not intended. What came in my mind was the Leo your translator, where you have big community behind that is working on answering how translation can be made between German and between other languages.
So Wenjin and I were looking at the video cases, video case studies on Roy P's website through TeachScape. I just wiped out what I was typing, but it's Roy P's website, or Roy P's video cases on TeachScape. TeachScape is a commercial company that does professional development for districts and groups, and they put up a bunch of professionally filmed video cases, but Roy has also worked on this video-based learning, using a Diver, which is like a 360 kind of camera. So I'm not sure exactly where those resources might be at this point, but he's got some of that stuff.
Okay, two interesting examples. So let me say a little bit more about how collective intelligence communities are defined. And this is drawn from an excellent paper by Malone et al., which is again on your readings list. They're researchers at MIT and have been examining characteristics of internet-based collective intelligent communities, not necessarily with any kind of educational application. And the idea here is facilitated by the internet loosely, an important word there, loosely organized groups of people work together. And they end up accomplishing tasks that seem to be more intelligent, more effective, and more efficiently done than working on their own. But what's important to note about this is just because you build a community, just because it's connected to the internet, doesn't mean you're going to have collective intelligence. There's a lot of nuances that seem to play into whether or not these communities will be successful, will tap into the best work of the brightest people to produce better artifacts or produce better decisions, whatever the goal of the community is. And what's challenging is to try to figure out, okay, what exactly, not collective non-intelligence, that often is an outcome. But even worse, I think what happens is there's no participation whatsoever. So it's important to think about what makes for a collective intelligence community. How do we engender productive contributions to harness the work of the best people? And so I highly recommend this paper as a way to think about some of these dimensions. And here's a couple more examples. Excellent, all excellent examples. Okay, so let's look at slide 5. So the general idea I'm putting forth here is this notion of teachers as designers who access open educational resources, engage in authoring through tools like the instructional architect, which I'll talk about in a moment, to engage in a kind of collective intelligence in something that we call crowd teaching. And in crowd teaching, there are small iterative cycles of continuous improvement in the process of instructional materials. And this taps into an idea from yet another article that's on your list by Morris and Hebert which came out in Educational Researcher, and puts forth a vision for creating shared instructional products. And again, I'll talk about this in a moment. But this is the broad outline of where I want to go today and some of the ideas that play into this. So let's go on to slide 6 and talk a little bit about the technology context. This is a system that we developed starting about 10 years ago. A number of people have been involved in this, called the Instructional Architect. It's a very simple system. I really want to emphasize simple. We were not interested in competing with learning management systems. We were not interested in competing with Google because we'd lose. Instead, we're trying to say, well, what's a very low bar of set of tools that are productive in terms of teachers accessing resources, building instructional materials, sharing these, and iteratively adapting them for their classroom context. So that's the basic idea. The idea is you can search for and integrate, teachers can search for and integrate open educational resources. They can create instructional materials around these, publish them, that is, make them available on the internet. Other teachers can view these, then copy them and modify them for their own instructional purposes, their own particular context. Let me show you on slide 7 a couple of examples of what we call projects or instructional materials created by teachers. It's kind of hard to read the slide, but the background here, the green part, shows something that a teacher created. And it's a pretty neat inquiry-oriented activity where there's a problem, there's some information sources, and then links to resources that students can then use to try to help solve this sort of open-ended problem. And you'll see one of the interactive resources that pops up in the right corner is a simulation to help students better understand density, because it turns out understanding the processes of density help you solve this problem. Okay, so that's a fairly elaborate example of something a teacher might create in the Instructional Architect. Here's another example, much, much simpler, where the teacher says, get your worksheet, get the worksheet, click on this link, and I think, I don't exactly remember, but I think this is a little game that helps you understand Newton's laws, and then you fill out the worksheet. So very simple use of online resources and student problem solving. Two very, in my mind, equally valid uses of online resources and instructional materials, but as you can imagine, very different implementation and enactment in classrooms. Now, I'm going to try to live on the edge here and do a little bit of a live demo of the Instructional Architect. So, Frank, I don't know if you want to shoot out, I think it's the third link I sent you. Yeah. Okay, so I hope you can all see the website. And again, we're kind of living on the edge here. I'm going to kind of describe how you might drive it so you can follow along. Again, if you're having some problems, type in the chat box and I'll try to help out. Okay, so there's basically two modes of usage. First one is you click on the I am a teacher box. We won't do this right now. If you're a student, you'd click on the student box and you'll see there's a very simple login that students type in and they can access what their teacher has designed for them. It's just one simple password, pass key. We wanted to avoid this whole finding out usernames for each individual student, coming up with associated passwords, and dealing with all the associated privacy issues. So it's just one passcode for all students, and the teacher is in control of that. So again, we're trying to not replicate a learning management system and turn over a lot of the control to the teachers. A teacher user on the other hand, can create a free account that enables him or her to, as I said earlier, access online resources, build simple instructional activities, make them public for the wider web, or make them public only for their students, or keep them private. So what I'd like you to do now, if you're still on this home page, ia.usu.edu, is to click on, let's just go to our Project Showcase page. So you click on Visit Project Showcase. And this is just this page is randomly generated. On the left side, you'll see some projects that were recently created by teachers. And again, all of you will see slightly different things because this was created, this is generated randomly. But what you can do is pick one of these links and click on it, and you can get a sense of what some of these teachers out there in the wild have been creating. And what often we see is a lot of math-oriented projects for younger grades. And I'm not sure exactly why that is, but that seems to be how a lot of the usage has been. Now, still on that project showcase page, you'll see some frequently hit projects. So these are popular projects. We keep track of the number of times that page has been accessed and show this on this page. And again, if you want to click on one of these links, remember you'll be seeing stuff that's slightly different than me, you'll see a teacher project and you can scroll down to the bottom, and I think it gives you a hit count, how many times some of these have been accessed. And some of these are in the thousands and tens of thousands. Again, with the internet and it's the distributed nature of the internet, not always necessarily sure who these people are and why certain projects are so popular. Back on the project showcase page, you'll see down the bottom projects created by teachers, IA projects created by teachers that use many OERs or many resources. So these people have found things and oftentimes created collections. And we find that those can often be very useful for other teachers because someone else has done the work to go out and find, for example, really good resources to help fifth graders learn fractions, for example. Okay, so hopefully you've had a chance to look at, in the wild, how some teachers have chosen to use the instructional architect, what kinds of instructional activities they have chosen to develop. Again, we're doing a very cursory browse of it, but our observations and our analyses show that they vary quite widely. They vary widely in complexity. Some are very short, like the example I showed you earlier, and some are more elaborate and really involve activities that might span several class periods. The other thing that a teacher can do is if they find an IA project that they like, they can copy it, and it gets copied into their workspace, and then they can edit it. And maybe you've come across that. You'll see a project down at the bottom. It'll say, this was copied from so-and-so. And here we get into this idea of teachers supporting one another, sharing instructional materials, allowing them to edit them for their own classroom context in ways that touch into this sort of crowd teaching notion that I mentioned earlier. And one of the things we've been doing, and I'll talk about now, is looking at how teachers are choosing to use these tools, how much adaptation are they in fact engaging in, and does this lead to better outcomes, very broadly defined. So I see a question here, and I think I'll just go ahead and take that right now. What is the stance strategy for quality control with the contributions? And this is just a great question. This is the old, how big brother are we going to be? How much of a censor role are we going to take? And it's something that we've batted around. I'm not sure we really have a great answer, but basically we take a very, very hands-off approach. We do, however, monitor the site several times weekly to look for spam. So, and that has happened, unfortunately, far too frequently than we'd like. So we've had, for example, I think the biggest case of spam was somebody, and I believe they were in Eastern Europe, creating IA projects that were selling Cialis. if some of you are familiar with that drug. And so we have a sort of a team of people that makes a judgment call whether or not it's spam. And of course, spam is somewhat in the eye of the beholder, although selling Cialis, there was no question there. And so we would delete these. And, you know, this is a word of caution for anyone who's trying to create an open environment for teaching and learning. I'm sure many of you have stumbled on this notion that one piece of inappropriate content can sink your project completely and unambiguously. So you have to be very mindful of that. If you're too mindful, however, you stifle the creativity of the participants, and that's something that we also want to avoid. So I'd love if anyone has better ideas. You know, I know there's software that does scan for spam, and we do use that as well, looking for traffic from known spammers, and that will get blocked. But it's a constant problem, and not a game that we'll ever completely win. Okay, back to a PowerPoint. We'll take a quick look at slide 9, some metrics that we've collected that have about 7,000 users who created 17,000 IA projects, collecting over 76,000 online learning resources with over 2.5 million hits. And, you know, that's a millisecond in the life of Google. But for our purposes, it's a very interesting data set, and one that we've been spending the last few years trying to look at, trying to make sense out of. So I wouldn't call it big data necessarily, but I'd call it semi-large data and somewhat interesting to look at. Okay, let's go to slide 10 and return to this paper that I mentioned earlier by Malone. And again, if you're interested in ideas of collective intelligence more broadly, peer production more broadly, I highly recommend this paper. In this paper, what they do is they sort of parse out online communities and ask a bunch of questions about particular communities. For example, what is the goal of this community and how do they do it? So is the goal to create artifacts, for example, encyclopedia articles, as is the goal for Wikipedia? Or is the goal to pick a winner, for example, by voting? Then who is engaged in the task? Is it an egalitarian crowd? That is, anyone can participate, anyone who has access to the internet. Or is there some sort of notion of hierarchy? And for example, Wikipedia over the years, as I understand it, it keeps implementing more and more of a hierarchy in order to manage the complex task of building an encyclopedia. Then finally, why do people engage in these tasks? Is it for money? And there's, for example, a site that I mentioned in the paper, Teachers Pay Teachers, where teachers can post their lesson plans and others can buy them for very small amounts of money. But you know, micro exchanges can translate into macro dollars if you have a winner. Or do they do this for the glory because it makes them feel good? And that seems largely to be the motivation, for example, in the Linux community. So just to pause here for a second and to think about some of the examples, and in particular, I like a lot of the examples that came out of the University of Washington. How do these questions apply to these different sites? And I'll pause here for a couple of minutes. So what I'd like you to do is think about a peer production site, a collective intelligence site that you know of, that we've talked about, and think about how these different questions might apply to analyzing these different sites. So I'll stop for a couple minutes here.
So we were thinking about this in terms of craft-based collective intelligence communities, like Ravelry, for example, where the goal of the community seems to be sharing ideas and sharing patterns, knitting patterns. So
So you'll have someone start off posting a pattern, and then other users will post pictures of the version of the pattern that they knit up themselves, and it tends to lead to folks selling patterns after they get a following, because there's also the ability to favorite things and that sort of thing.
And then we talked a bit about kind of a parallel in education with Nicole Pinker's effort within the Remix communities, where you have students who specialize in particular aspects of digital media production, whether it's song or video, and then they contribute those elements out into the broader community, and they get kind of taken up by others, and the creators not only get some fame and visibility and maybe badges awarded, but they also then get, or used to actually get, Remix dollars that they could actually turn in for things that they were hoping for, you know, as well. So kind of a little microeconomy around that digital work.
Okay, thanks for that contribution. So there was a couple interesting ideas in that, this sharing artifacts that can be modified. And I think another example is the Scratch community. So Scratch is a kid-oriented programming language, and you can post your code on the Scratch site for others to use and remix and create something new. And then I think people whose programs get accessed a lot get put on the home page or something like that. I'm not exactly positive. So there's this glory element is the motivation. I think Phil Bell mentioned badges. That's another way that there's some reward structure going on, or remix dollars. I hadn't heard of that one. So there's yet another reward structure. So lots of nuances in how these communities can be implemented to attract participants, to get participants engaged, and to reward participants. Again, I still think we don't have a very good handle on what makes for then a sustainable community, given all these variables. So just a couple of questions in the chat window. Susan asked, leaving feedback, and I think Frank asked a related question. There is a way within the Instructional Architect where you can look at, you can click on a link that says about this project, and you can actually leave a rating for it. What we have found is people seldom use that feature. And I think there's a couple of explanations for that. One explanation might be that it's not readily apparent in the interface. Another explanation is that, in fact, people in general are far more consumers of rating information than they are providers of rating information. And this is true on any kind of website you look at, that people are far more likely to consume than they are to produce and to contribute to that. So I think that this idea of reviewing or leaving comments or rating or about the quality of the artifacts is an important idea. How to do this in a way that is thoughtful and really does engage people instead of a small minority is still something we haven't quite solved. Okay, so let's go on to slide 11. And what we've done here is shown how some of these dimensions identified by Malone and his colleagues play out within the Instructional Architect. So there's a create dimension and two decide dimensions. Malone kind of highlights these as different dimensions in a community. The creating involves teachers building these IA projects, and we've looked at some examples. Through a lot of our work, we've tried to get at why teachers are motivated to do this. Many are motivated to use technology because they think it's part of their students' worldview these days. They want to supplement their textbook. They also want to increase their efficiency in the classroom. Those are some of the motivations. And how they do it is they create these personal collections of projects. The decide dimension is, as a user of the IA, I can view a teacher project, and that way I can leverage the wisdom of the crowd. And I can learn from my peers, and I can also learn from the resources that teachers have embedded. And how I do this is by viewing a public IA project. I can also decide to copy one. I come across one I really like, and I do this individually. Again, I'm leveraging the wisdom of my peers, of the crowd, and I can improve my efficiency and effectiveness because I'm building off of something that a teacher has already done. I have an upcoming unit on fractions. Fractions we well know is challenging for many students. I'm interested in ways to teach it. I go to the IA, I find a bunch of lessons around fractions that use some very cool open educational resources. I can build on that, I can copy this, and I can use it in my classroom. So there's this idea I'm building on what teachers have already done. So that's a particular approach that the IA supports. So let's turn to slide 12, and I want to give one more theoretical motivation, and this comes from a paper I alluded to earlier by Morrison Hebert, came out in Educational Researcher. It's on your list of readings. And they put forth, I think, a very compelling vision about how we might get continued improvement in educational settings. In the United States, anyway, too often I think we have very large changes that come out. For example, rolling out next-gen science standards, rolling out the Common Core. And these are abrupt changes. These can be difficult changes, even though they are very well intentioned and very well motivated. And the argument that these folks put forth is maybe we should think about small incremental changes, moving toward continuous improvement in what we do. And the way we get there is by creating public and changeable knowledge artifacts in which participants can jointly solve, share, and refine their problems of practice. And when this is enabled, where you have these publicly and jointly created multiple sources of innovation, we get incremental improvement and we get multiple sources of innovation. And Morrison Hebert say that they think that two types of organizations are particularly well suited for this, and that's healthcare and that's education. And this is a vision they put forth. They argue that we don't really see this on a wide scale in education, although they do put forth some very interesting examples, and argue that this is maybe some way we could move forward. Now, they don't really give a means for implementing this vision. And what we like to put forth is maybe this idea of collective intelligence is a way to support this vision. So again, I'm going to turn this over to a moment of contemplation if you're on your own or in your shared groups to sort of think about this last question of how this idea of public and shared artifacts and collective intelligence in the realm of education might fit together. So again, I'll pause for just a couple minutes.
Sure. Just a little bit on that. So over the last couple of years, Bill Penuel and Barry Fishman and colleagues have been developing this idea of design-based implementation research that thinks about working at broader scale in sustained ways within and across communities as a design endeavor. So kind of really attaching kind of an organizational theory take on how do we bring our really innovative learning environments to more and more places. Then it turns around this idea of identifying emergent problems of practice that are broadly felt that then people can come up with tools and strategies that either work locally or could be adapted in multiple sites to kind of help support learning. And so we're starting to do more of this work across Seattle and Renton school districts as they implement the standards to think about you know, particular aspects of that new vision in the standards and what are the problems that come up and how do we develop tools that can be adapted locally to engage with them and support learning.
So I just wanted to, I've been typing a couple of points into the chat window, but I wanted to bring up this issue of the relationship between incremental change and true innovation. We find that one of the challenges we're looking at trying to work in design collaborative design teams with practicing teachers to develop modules that are examples of actually implementing the Common Core standards in English language arts, history, and science in terms of the literacy practices that are developed for those in the Common Core standards. And one of the challenges we find is that there is a tendency to look at some of that stuff and kind of say, we do that already, or, oh, I can do that. And then what's done is not really getting at the kind of disciplinary practice at all. It's sort of on the surface doing that. It's making incremental change, but it's not really making the kind of change in the learning objectives, the learning goals, and the way instruction's going on that would truly be innovative ways to actually redo, or not redo, but redesign instruction so that fundamentally in the forefront were the kinds of practices and the disciplines that the Common Core is in fact calling for. So I think that's a challenge of what how incremental change relates to innovation, really. And for me, a little bit, they're contradictory ideas, but I think it's an interesting point to put out there.
Yes, excellent point. There is a tension between innovation and incremental change. And I think part of it has to do with who are the players in the community. And I think what design-based implementation research is, tries to include more stakeholders, more players in the community that might than might typically have been involved to bring about innovation. But I think you're exactly right. Incremental change could also just be continuous wheel reinvention and not really forward progress. I just wanted to reflect there quickly on Suzanne Miller's comment about the small producer base versus a large consumer base. And I think that, I'm not sure exactly I know what's getting at here, but that's also a factor of the community. How many people are actively producing versus how many people are actively consuming, and what's that balance, and who are these people that are the producers versus the consumers? And this gets back to, I think, the fundamental questions that Malone and colleagues ask about who's involved and why are they involved? And that then plays out in the health of the community. So I don't have the answers. I wish I did. But I think it's really forces us to examine these communities in more nuanced ways rather than simply saying, oh, it's participation, so it must be great. Just quickly, I know there was, it's hard to keep up with chat and there's just quite a lot going on, which is really great. I'm excited that there's a lot of this back talk going on. So let me just quickly look through here. I think there was some initial discussions about, or initial comments about the cream rising to the top in something like the instructional architect through like buttons and star ratings. And again, I think these are all great ideas. Certainly other communities do this. It's a two-pronged problem in our case. It's making it easy in the interface, easy to do, because if it's hard, of course, people don't. And the second prong problem is getting people who might be more traditionally consumers to be participators in that realm, and then knowing whether or not you can trust their opinion. And yeah, there's a big literature on this, and I won't get into this right now. And I see we just have 20 minutes left, so perhaps we shall move on. So let's quickly turn to slide 13, and I'm going to walk through some study results. They're contained in the paper in gory detail. So I will just give you a skim level here. So we wanted to examine some of these questions in the context of the IA community. And so we want to look at some of our data in a more principled way. And so we had two research questions, one largely focused on teachers. How are they engaging in collective intelligent activities? And artifacts. Do the artifacts they create, in this case, instructional architect projects, which are instructional materials, do collective intelligent processes relate to how useful these might be? And these are very broad questions, and let me just talk to you a little bit about how we got at them. For research question one, we looked at 757 users who created an account during one calendar year. Now, when you create an account, you're asked to indicate whether or not you're a teacher. This is an optional profile information, and of these, 200 people indicated that they were teachers. Now, of these 757, probably many more are teachers, but they didn't necessarily tell that in our profile, so we excluded them. And those 200 people created 520 IE projects. For research question two, we looked more closely at 36 middle school math and science teachers who participated in professional development and learned the and used the instructional architect. They created 351 IA projects as part of this professional development. And we looked more closely at two that each of them created and that they told us they used in their classroom. Trying to keep up on the back chat here. Our data sources was this teacher demographic data. Who are you? Their usage data. How did you use the instructional architect? This is slide 15. What were the features of the projects they created? And then we had two measures of the actual artifact itself, the OAI score and the PBL score. And I'll talk about these in a second. I'm wondering if I should just take a brief moment and let UW jump in to talk about their pedagogical cultures, because I'm intrigued as well. So I'm putting UW on the spot again.
So we don't, it was going back to the quality control discussion. So you know, one idea is to have a centralized way that might happen top down. Another way is to actually just let different emergent practitioner communities flourish around, yeah, you know, where they would see different resources being quality given maybe their stance. So towards teaching and learning, which we might have professional reactions to given other things we know, but at some level in a bottom-up crowdsourced way, you might allow these different communities to pull together more high-quality collections from their different perspectives. That was the kernel of an idea that we had. Over.
Thank you. Yeah, intriguing. Okay, maybe moving along here, slide 16 is more gory detail on these data sources. Slide 17, I'll go into a little more detail on evaluating the collective intelligence artifacts. So in this case, how do we start to look at what teachers are creating? And we heard an interesting idea about how maybe it relates to the pedagogical culture. But what our approach chose to do was to look at to what extent was the IA project display elements of inquiry-based learning, and in particular problem-based learning. The second dimension is to what extent does it integrate open educational resources into the IA project. And here we use the scale developed by Brown and Adelson at Northwestern University, where they were looking at how teachers chose to implement an enact curriculum, and they came up with a three-part scale. An offload is you take a piece of curriculum materials and you implement it, enact it in your classroom unchanged. That's an offload. An adapt is you make slight tweaks to it. An improvisation is you really just have that curriculum material as something that's a reference, if you will. And in fact, most of the teaching responsibility falls onto the teacher. Okay, these are not value judgments, these are just three ways a piece of curriculum could be enacted. And we said, well, let's look at this in terms of IA projects. Are you offloading to open educational resources? Are you adapting them? Or are you improvising by building on them in your own ways and also copying what other teachers may have done? So we have a problem-based learning alignment rubric. I won't go into the details, but we coded some of these IA projects along these dimensions you see in the leftmost column. To what extent is this a problem-based learning IA project? And then we used, as I said, for the second dimension, this OAI scale, offload, adaptation, improvisation. Those are the three dimensions that you could be rated, the project could be rated. So research question one, some very quick results here. This is looking at 200 teachers' activity over the course of 1 year and some of the IA project features. So Let's see. First of all, we see, and if we look at red, we'll just look at the red very quickly, that they're using, they've found approximately 16 OERs they're using, so they're definitely building around open educational resources on the web. They're creating a very small number of projects on average, 2.6, but they're choosing to make them public to benefit the community. They're adapting or copying about 15% of their projects from others, and they're viewing about 12. So there's a lot more viewing going on than there is copying. If you go on to slide 21, what's also very important to notice, and is apparent in the previous slide, is none of these values are normally distributed. Instead, we tend to see a distribution that is called a ZIPF distribution. This one isn't exactly one, but it's close, in that in this histogram, you'll see on the left side, this is slide 21, that many of the teachers, many of the participants are not logging in very often, whereas a few are logging in very frequently. Okay, so a very skewed distribution. And I point this out to say that this is very common in internet data sets, these kinds of distributions. This is sometimes referred to the participation inequality distribution that shows that in any kind of internet community, a few of the people are engaged in most of the activities. And if you think about, you know, this is a very simple example, you think about Facebook, probably a few of your friends do most of the contributing into the feeds. And most of your friends contribute little or very little. Okay, so this is a fundamental property, and we see it here in the IA, and in most communities, you're going to see this. And it's just the fact of what it is, and not something that you should, that you should worry about. Looking at a couple other results here on slide 22, teachers were asked to tell us their comfort with technology. And we see rating this on a scale of 1 to 3, low, medium, high. You'll see that teachers who indicated, self-indicated high comfort with technology were the people that created the most IA projects. Not very surprising. So we see this kind of idea that participation here seems to be mediated by your comfort with technology. In slide 23, however, we'll see that teaching experience didn't really seem to be related to how much you participated or got engaged in the community. So we see that all levels of teaching experience, participation by teachers. So that's an interesting finding, no clear pattern here. So summary of research question one, we see very varying levels of teacher participation. This is the distribution I talked about. Comfort by it with technology mediates it. We see way more consuming in the sense of viewing IA projects than producing this participation inequality. Now the question turns to research question two, how projects are valued in the community. We looked at IA project alignment with inquiry-based learning and use of open educational resources. That was slide 24. Slide 25, you can see me speeding up as we approach the end of our time. If you recall here, this was a more in-depth focus of 36 teachers who participated in a professional development that, as part of the professional development, they used the instructional architect. Essentially in blue, the blue values are highlighted blue to contrast with the data I showed you for the in-the-wild users, the teachers who just come to the IA. And here the values, not surprisingly, are much higher. So that means, of course, you can cultivate participation in a community, in our case, through professional development. So much, much higher participation rates if it was part of a sustained experience. That's the main takeaway here. In slide 26, we tried to look at some correlations between problem-based learning alignment and features of IA projects. And basically what we see is projects that had a high PBL alignment or inquiry alignment tended to have more words, not surprisingly, but also tended to be viewed more often. There was a correlation there. So somehow teachers are finding these and viewing them more often. In terms of that OAI dimension, how they use open educational resources, we tend to see a correlation between improvisation projects and number of words, and also number of edits. Teachers are working harder on these, and number of times it's been copied. So yet again, the community seems to be finding these improvisation projects and choosing to copy them. And if we view copying as an indirect proxy of quality, this is kind of interesting finding there. So summary of research question two, users in the wild showed overall lower levels of activity. Not surprising, the message is we can cultivate community, but it takes some effort. Point number two, slide 27, two key IA project features, number of views and number of words, were significant and positive predictors of PBL alignment score. So we could say that maybe these usage features, numbers of copies, numbers of views, number of words, might be indirect proxies of quality. That could be a useful way of starting to separate the wheat from the chaff among IA projects. And this touches on a point that we talked about earlier. We didn't find any real teacher characteristics correlated with how their PBL alignment or OAI score. So the ability to create these kinds of projects seems to be distributed throughout the teacher community. And so that's yet another interesting finding. So in conclusion, slide 28, we can maybe have an indirect proxy of utility by looking at number of words, views, number of times copied. And interestingly, a study of Wikipedia found this as well, that number of words seem to indicate Wikipedia articles that had high value to users, to visitors to the Wikipedia site. So, and that's a very easy metric to compute, obviously. We could think about how the user interface might reflect some of these utility measures in order to help better leverage crowd wisdom. So there's this idea that wisdom ought to be perhaps reflected in an interface design, and that's something we have not explored. And of course, the limitation, small number of teachers, small number of IA projects, and unclear motivations about why some teachers participate here. So hard to generalize. And so I close with a quote from Picasso that about good artists copying, great artists steal, this idea that we want to celebrate this teachers leveraging from each other's work, and this idea of celebrating collective intelligence as a way to enable people, teachers to build on the work of each other to perhaps lead to incremental changes in what they do. So I'm sorry I really sped up there in at the end, because I realized we only have about 8 minutes left. And so I guess I'll open it for comments and discussion. I know that was kind of rapid fire there at the end, but I did love our conversation early on about some of the theoretical underpinnings of this work. So the question from Susan here about participating around projects, not just participation through copying and viewing. Currently, there is no mechanism for this. I mentioned early, one of our design principles was keep it simple. We're not trying to compete with existing tools out there that do build in ways for the teachers actually to interact around the materials. I do think, yes, that would be a valuable next step. So it's not just modification of artifacts, but also discussion, sharing of ideas, something like you might get in a lesson study, and not something we've implemented, but something we could probably embed by leveraging the functionalities that exist in our existing tools, for example, as offered by the Google platform.
I would like to bring in an international perspective or international questions. So, in Germany we have 16 states, And all of these states have different systems for teacher education and also different regulations for teachers working in school and so on. And but what is really common in all of these 16 states is with respect to this kind of collective intelligence perspective on or crowd teaching, you have an official perspective that says, well, we have problems with quality control because all the resources that are used in the classroom have to be approved somehow by some ministry. So this is one challenge. I think we discussed that a bit earlier. And the other challenge is also the intellectual property rights situation. So in many cases, teachers, and there were some investigations, studies here as well in Germany, teachers are very, very unsure about what they are allowed to use and what can bring them into jail if they use it in the classroom. We have currently also discussions to, well, more or less abandon the use of Facebook and other social networks in classroom or for homework or things like that. So this is, and this is not Germany is not the only case for that. I think in France it's much more advanced. So there is no more or less no usage of social network technologies in the classroom. So I wonder if this is similar in the US, and so we are have some kind of very, let's say, optimistic perspective or idealist perspective on that, or is there a good chance that you see where how we can overcome these issues?
Oh, great set of issues. And this is sort of the policy environment that surrounds integration of technology and the can of worms that it opens up. And I think in many levels, in many cases, we have the same issues here in the United States. And I was reading about, I mentioned in Israel as well, there's a very it's a very regulatory environment in terms of, for example, using Facebook in schools. It's simply not allowed. So to try to address some of your issues, the we have Creative Commons attribution on all the instructional architect projects. So share alike. I'm not very clear that teachers understand Creative Commons license. I'm not clear that I always understand all the nuances of Creative Commons license, but that's an approach to say if you use the site, it means it's there to be reused. And we kind of defer the licensing issues around the open educational resources because the projects really typically just have links to these resources. So they're still hosted on that site. It's not like we've copied anything. And those have been our ways of handling this because yes, in the early days, these were very big consideration. Another issue that we run into here, and I'm sure it's the same in many countries around the world, is filters on internet access. So many sites are blocked because of concerns about appropriateness. And again, this becomes sort of in the eye of the beholder. Someone is acting as a censor. One person may think it's a very useful educational resource, others may not. And I know that teachers frequently run into that hurdle. So what may be allowed in one educational setting may be blocked in another. And that, of course, can be a very frustrating situation. I don't have a good solution. And yeah, let's take one more question if there is one. Oh yes, yeah, so Susan Miller brings up the scripted curriculum. And I think this is a very good point as well, and one that's addressed in that Remillard article. To what extent are teachers handed teacher-proof curriculums where they have to be following it using pacing guides or whatever the district might have come up with? So such that in some cases, teachers are turning the same page at the same time in classroom throughout an area. And we have lots of variability, I think, in that here in the United States, perhaps less so internationally. So, Yeah, I guess the final question here, thank you for that. I think it seems a little bit related to something that Susan brought up earlier, which is not just content, but conversations around content and the role that can play in teacher learning and perhaps in continual improvement. And no, that's not something we have explored in terms of technology. It is something we've explored in the context of professional development. And it is a logical next step to look at. Yes. I'm going to hand it over to Susan here.
So we're just about out of time. We would, of course, love your feedback on how you think the session went. I also want to thank Mimi for doing a great job of walking us through this stuff and providing lots of opportunities for us to input into the session. Frank says we need a German version of IA. All right, well. there's a great comment from Freda, I think it's from, no, University of Washington, and some new resources that we might look at. So again, I want to thank everybody, and I'm sure we'll get another email from Frank about the next one, and thank Frank and Freitas for making all of this work, as well as Mimi for preparing a really good context for learning and discussion. So thanks, everybody.